You could be a lemon tree, Dave.
Yeah, indeed.
Podcasting from an underground studio flying under the radar, this is Dan. By day, I'm a professor of cognitive neuroscience, and by night, I retreat into my subterranean lair and dig deep into the thoughts of mankind.
We like to say people kind, not necessarily mankind, because it's more inclusive.
There we go, exactly.
And I'm Dave, sitting firmly atop the Great Canadian Shield in Northern Ontario. I'm a pastor by profession, and a part of that includes unmasking the messaging that comes at us each and every day.
We will not conform.
You're listening to the Not Conformed Podcast.
Welcome, everyone, to episode 2 of the Not Conformed Podcast. We're glad you've tuned in for our conversation. Dave, before we get started, here is a message to you from my kids.
Happy birthday, Uncle Dave!
Thank you.
Yeah, so I understand you're 40. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, happy birthday.
Thank you. Thank you.
By the way, for our non-Canadian listeners, the voice you hear exhorting us to use people kind in the intro belongs to our esteemed Canadian leader, Justin Trudeau. And I searched for the definition of people kind on the internet, and one of the top results that came up was a definition from the urbandictionary.com. And this seems to be a site where people post definitions, and the most popular one bubbles up to the top. And when I clicked on the audio button for the top rated definition, here is what I heard.
An idiotic description mentioned by the imbecile PM Justin Trudeau, who interrupted a woman asking a serious question using the word mankind. Justin informed her the correct word to be used was people kind, as it was gender neutral. Justin immediately became the butt of many jokes, laughed at on talk shows, and was ridiculed worldwide.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, I don't know if you caught that, but they call Justin just Dim.
Dim, yeah.
J-U-S-T-D-I-M. Right? So it's kind of like a popular sourced definition that's sourced online, right? So it's not actually an official thing, but I thought it was quite humorous.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic.
So today we want to continue with our propaganda theme, focusing on the history of propaganda.
Yeah. So one of the purposes of this podcast is to expose you to some primary sources or scholars who have written on this topic. And so I want to outline three useful books to read on this topic. The first one being Propaganda, written by Edward Bernays and published in 1928. And he was the granddaddy of public relations. He gives a history of the concept of propaganda, and we'll get into that in a bit. The second is Propaganda Techniques in the World War by Harold D. Lasswell, first published in 1927. And he was a major figure in the field of political science, and his book is as much a propaganda manual as an analysis of the propaganda techniques used in World War I. And the third one is by Arthur Ponsonby, and it's titled Falsehood in Wartime. And it was published again in 1929. And this would have come out after World War I, which ended in 1918, and before World War II, which you'll remember began in 1939. And his book kind of dissects the documents of wartime falsehood peddled during World War I by then ostensibly the good countries like Britain and America. So we're gonna bring some of these sources in as we continue to discuss the topic of propaganda.
Now, Dave, let's start with the definition of propaganda that we introduced in one of the previous episodes, and we used a simple Google definition. The definition from Google that we used was, quote, information, especially of a biased or misleading nature, used to promote or publicize a particular political cause or point of view. And so as you could see, it implies not positive things, right? Deception, manipulation, falsehood. But interestingly, there is some evidence that this wasn't always the way that propaganda was defined. And according to Bernays' book, so this is the one that you mentioned titled Propaganda, the concept of propaganda initially had a much more positive connotation. And he traces the use of the term to the Roman Catholic Church, actually, where it was used to name a committee in the church that was tasked with spreading the accepted doctrine and countering what they perceived what would be the false doctrine being spread by the Protestant churches. Bernays' book includes a very good introduction by a guy named Mark Miller, and he names the committee. It was called the Office for the Propagation of the Faith, and if I'm going to say it in a different language here, you got to excuse me, Congregatio de Propaganda Fide. So as you could see, the word propaganda appeared in the name. According to Bernays, originally the word propaganda just meant spreading a message and presumably a true message.
So that's like the early 1600s then.
That's right. That would be the early 1600s that this occurred. And so you can imagine just before that you had the Protestant Reformation. And so the Roman Catholic Church was probably on its heels and trying to send out its doctrine. Now, by the time Bernays' book came out, and as Dave mentioned, as you mentioned, it was in 1927 or 1928. By that time, the term propaganda already had a negative connotation. And it seems to be the case that at the beginning of his book, Bernays tries to save the term propaganda to make it wholesome again. And I wonder if linking it to the Roman Catholic Church is a part of his propaganda to try to baptize, so to speak, or cleanse this term propaganda.
Yeah, of course, that's kind of depends on your outlook, right? Because from the perspective of the Protestants or us Lutherans, the Roman Church was actually spreading propaganda or false teaching, as to be more precise.
Exactly. So even back then, it's all about the perspective that you take. Now, intriguingly, Dave, if you take a look at the Google second definition, what do you read?
So we've got a committee of cardinals of the Roman Catholic Church responsible for foreign missions, founded in 1622 by Pope Gregory the 15th.
The 15th, yeah. So you notice that also makes it into the Google definition. So this bit of history has actually bubbled up as kind of a secondary definition of the term propaganda.
It's interesting how the term propagation or propaganda, how it came from the church and then filtered into the secular sphere, just like kind of the words evangelism and outreach have done the same thing. You'll see those corporations have outreach or evangelism people.
Well, even though it might have been initially started out as a positive term, the term propaganda suffered irrevocable damage during World War I. And it sustained heavy casualties during the war, just like people from all sorts of countries involved. And I think there are three reasons for this that I picked out of the books that I've read. And the first reason is that during the war, the propaganda that was spread included a lot of falsehood. And here's a quote from Harold Lasswell. Quote, "Actually, propaganda, wherever studied, has a large element of fake in it. This varies from putting a false dateline on a dispatch through the printing of unverified rumors, the printing of denials in order to convey an insinuation, to the staging of events." And we'll get into more of those details later on, but you see here he's saying it always or often had a lot of fake in it. And later on he says, "It was not unusual during the war to invent a great deal of material out of whole cloth." So just fundamental, basic fabrication of information, and then that information is being spread to the people. The second reason that propaganda got a bad name was that the falsehoods that were spread were not only done by the so-called bad countries like Germany, but also by the good countries like Britain and America. And I think a lot of people out there, Dave, think that maybe propaganda started out in Germany during World War II, because you guys...
Bad Germans.
Yeah, exactly. Everybody thinks of Goebbels and all these evil things. But it turns out that the modern use of propaganda was really started in England and in America, and not so much actually by Germany. So that's a very interesting detail of history that's often glossed over or completely missed.
Interesting. Yeah, kind of like eugenics, which we'll have to get into some point as well.
Yeah, yes, indeed. And I guess the third reason why propaganda got a bad name was that during the war, propaganda was not only used against the enemy, as one would often assume. People might think, oh, it's okay to lie to the enemy. It's a part of war. But here's the critical part. It was also used on the government's own people. So in other words, the British and the Americans were spreading lies to their own people. Now, Dave, why would they do this?
Well, one reason was to motivate people to get into and stay engaged in the war. As I understand, the American and the British populations were not open to foreign wars, and they didn't want to get into the war. And so the government used propaganda to motivate the people to back the war, essentially.
Yeah, here's what Ponsonby writes. Quote, The use of the weapon of falsehood is more necessary in a country where military conscription is not the law of the land than in countries where the manhood of the nation is automatically drafted into the army, navy, or air service. The public can be worked up emotionally by sham ideas. A sort of collective hysteria spreads and rises until finally it gets the better of sober people and reputable newspapers. And Harold Lasswell writes the following, quote, "So great are the psychological resistances to war in modern nations that every war must appear to be a war of defense against a menacing, murderous aggressor. There must be no ambiguity about whom the public is to hate." And of course, to create that impression, you have to use propaganda and spread some lies about the enemy. Now, an impressive list of the sorts of falsehoods that were manufactured by the good governments during World War I is provided by Lord Ponsonby. And he gives an exhaustive treatment of these. So here it is. I'm just going to go through these, Dave, and then
go for it.
We'll go on to some details.
I got a bunch of examples. So maybe do you want to go through the whole list?
I'll go through the whole list. Yeah.
Okay. So I won't jump in. Go through the list. It's fairly long, but then we'll talk about some actual examples.
Yeah. Okay. Here we go. So this is a series of quotes. Okay. Quote, "There is the deliberate official lie issued either to delude the people at home or to mislead the enemy abroad. Quote, there is the lie heard and not denied, although lacking in evidence, and then repeated or allowed to circulate. Quote, there is the mistranslation occasionally originating in a genuine mistake, but more often deliberate. There is the general obsession started by rumor and magnified by repetition and elaborated by hysteria, which at last gains general acceptance. There is a deliberate forgery which has to be very carefully manufactured, but serves its purpose at the moment, even though it be eventually exposed." I want everybody to remember that one. "There is the omission of passages from official documents, of which only a few of the many instances are given. There is deliberate exaggeration. There's a concealment of truth. There's the faked photograph. The camera cannot lie." He adds, "These were more common in France than here," and here was Britain. So France was using a lot of these fake photographs.
Mm-hmm.
The cinema also played a very important part, especially in neutral countries, and helped considerably in turning opinion in America in favor of coming in on the side of the Allies. To this day, in this country, attempts are made by means of films to keep the wound raw. Then there is the, quote, Russian scandal.
To influence our election.
The Trump-Russia scandal.
There was clearly some collusion.
Cooperation and collusion.
Dave, it's the same playbook. They used it over 100 years ago. They're using it again.
That's the thing, right? Reduce, reuse, recycle. And so it was 100 years ago. We haven't done the Russian scare for a while. The Cold War's over. So let's brown in service, rewarm that puppy up. And and now we're back on Russian hysteria, anti-Russian hysteria again.
They just dusted off. And I think he was referring to some false story that Russian troops were marching through Britain.
Right.
It turned out that was completely false, but it was circulated. And, oh, no, the Russians, right? So there's a Russian scandal. Okay, here's another quote. "Atrocity lies were the most popular of all, especially in this country and America. No war can be without them." And we're going to focus a lot on that one. Quote, "The repetition of a single instance of cruelty and its exaggeration can be distorted into a prevailing habit on the part of the enemy." Quote, "There are lies emanating from the inherent unreliability and fallibility of human testimony. There are evasions, concealments, and half-truths which are more subtly misleading and gradually become a governmental habit. There is official secrecy which must necessarily mislead public opinion." And here he talks about a series of secret treaties that were denied publicly but were entered in privately. "There is the sham official indignation." And the final one I have on my list is, "There are personal accusations and false charges made in a prejudiced war atmosphere to discredit persons who refuse to adopt the orthodox attitude towards war." Yeah, so what you see here in this list, and the reason I thought it would be worth reading it, is how comprehensive, extensive, and varied these propaganda techniques were. And they involved some combination of the government, media, and private interests. And of course, some of these were used on the enemy, but some, and perhaps many, were used on the propagandists' own people. Dave, this is shocking.
That's right. And the key thing is just to remember that these are being used by the ostensibly good countries, in air quotes, like Britain and America.
That's right.
You know, and obviously by everybody else too, but that's the point we're trying to make here.
Yeah, I think a lot of people think, you know, the government wouldn't lie to us. They're elected officials and there must be checks and balances and all sorts of things. But here we see that they actually did do a lot of lying. They actually set up, you know, a committee. And Britain had one. Actually, they had multiple that were kind of actually in competition for a while, and then that resolved itself. And the Americans had one. I mean, every country really ultimately later on sets up these committees that control information. And not only the information that's broadcast outside of their country, but also the information that's propagated to the people, to their own people inside their country. So, Dave, let's now go over some specific examples of these war-related false propaganda techniques and the propaganda that was peddled by British and American governments. And maybe you could give some examples from World War I that were described by Lord Ponsonby, but also maybe we can get into some examples that are more modern that have to do with more of the recent wars that have occurred within our lifetime, Dave.
Yeah, sure. I've got a handful of articles for that, and if I forget to bring them in now, I'll bring them in later. But the best place to start, or at least one place to start, because there's a whole bunch of these on this list, is the atrocity lies. So these are the lies that governments, particularly in this case Britain and the U.S., peddle to their own people to paint the enemy as being so evil that they must be eliminated. And one of my favorite examples is the Belgian baby without hands.
Oh, okay, my.
So I'm gonna, yeah.
Okay.
Right.
That doesn't sound good, okay. Dave.
No, it doesn't. But it's we'll see how this is not a – it's again, one of these Brown and Serve scenarios, or it becomes one. So, quote, not only did the Belgian baby, whose hands had been cut off by the Germans, travel through the towns and villages of Great Britain, but it went through Western Europe and America into the Far West. Now, no one paused to ask how long a baby would live were its hands cut off, unless expert surgical aid were at hand to tie up the arteries. The answer, of course, being a very few minutes. Everyone wanted to believe the story, and many went so far as to say that they had seen the baby. The lie was as universally accepted as the passage of the Russian troops through Britain.
And that was a lie. That was a lie that we had referred to before.
Never happened.
Yeah, it never happened. And so this is from Ponsonby's book, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the question, Dave, is does this happen now? Here we can maybe move to the 1990s. So not that long ago, actually. I was a teenager in the 1990s. And this was a time when the U.S. was in the first Iraq war, and they were trying to find a reason to invade Iraq. And this was during the Iraq-Kuwait conflict. And of course, the question would be, why would Americans care about this thing that was happening across the sea in Iraq? Well, they probably didn't care. And so they had to create some propaganda to motivate the people. And so, of course, when you do that, you need a really good atrocity story. And so I have a clip here from a testimony to the U.S. Congress by a Kuwaiti girl who was at the time only introduced as Naira to conveniently protect her identity. Here is the clip.
I stayed behind and wanted to do something for my country. The second week after invasion, I volunteered at the Al-Adan Hospital.
She's crying.
With 12 other women who wanted to help as well.
Wiping off tears.
I was the youngest volunteer. The other women were from 20 to 30 years old. While I was there, I saw the Iraqi soldiers come into the hospital with guns. They took the babies out of the incubators. Took the incubators and left the children to die on the cold floor.
They threw the babies on the floor.
It was horrifying. I could not help but think of my nephew, who, if born premature, might have died that day as well.
See, Dave, it's the babies again.
The babies in the incubators.
The bad guys, they tend to kill the babies.
That's right.
Yeah. And so Bush Sr., he was the U.S. president at the time, used the story many times to justify entering into the conflict. And so there are a lot of speeches with him referring to this story.
And they had kids in incubators, and they were thrown out of the incubators so that Kuwait could be systematically dismantled.
Babies pulled from incubators and scattered like firewood across the floor.
Yeah, so those are just two examples, but there were many more. I have this Guardian article here, Dave.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, dealing
Which
with
the disinformation campaign, that one?
That's right. Yeah, it's a disinformation campaign. And the subtitle is Western media follow a depressingly familiar formula when it comes to the preparation of a nation for conflict. So they figured out the model, Dave. They figured out the formula. But here's a quote from that article. Quote, take the Kuwaiti baby story. Its origins go back to the First World War when British propaganda accused the Germans of tossing Belgian babies into the air and catching them on their bayonets, Dave. so that's a very nice twist to the Belgian baby stories. Now they're throwing them up and catching them up on, for the young listeners, would be the knives that were at the ends of their guns and basically skewering the babies on those bayonets. And the key point, of course, here is that the U.S. and her allies are playing from the exact same playbook that was used in World War One. And in fact, Dave, the similarity in the stories is uncanny.
That's right. And I think it's in that same article that they point out that it wasn't until 2 years later the truth actually came out, and that this story was a fabrication and a myth, and that this Naira, this teenage girl, Kuwaiti girl, she was actually coached and rehearsed by Hill and Knowlton for her appearance before that congressional committee, and was in fact the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States.
Oh my goodness, yeah. I mean, that's so blatant though, Dave. Like, it's in your face. Okay, here you have the daughter of the ambassador, and she's just put up. And how is it the case that actually the Congress didn't even know this girl, or nobody did their research? I mean, it's so easy to fool people. It's so bizarre.
Well, and the when you read the list there, one of the things was you put something out and you know it's going to get discovered, but it doesn't matter because the work has been done. And it's in this Guardian article that they write, by the time MacArthur revealed this, the war was won and over, and it did not matter anymore.
Yeah. That's right. So if you just have to have the lie hold on for a while, stick for a while, but it doesn't have to stick forever.
That's right, because everybody forgets, nobody cares, right? You just remember, you don't even remember your source, you just remember this feeling of those evil Iraqis or those evil Germans or whatever, and you completely forget how this thought came into your mind.
Yeah, and I think even the people who might have known about this and they realized, oh, you know, they lied to us, I think they come to believe that maybe that was back then, but the current people we have in power, they wouldn't lie to us. So they always think it's just those former governments, but now we have a new government, and of course, they're going to be telling us the truth.
Yeah, it's funny how we fall into this historical chauvinism, even within stuff that we ought to be able to remember ourselves within our own lifetimes.
Yeah. Turns out, yeah, that testimony by this girl, Naira, swayed both congressional and public opinions so heavily that it did play a big role in getting the U.S. into that war. Now, I think we should now, Dave, be able to smell an atrocity scam going down when the prime minister or the president, whoever, sets what they call the red line. The red line, Dave, listen.
I have, at this point, not ordered military engagement in the situation, but the point that you made about...
So this is Obama talking about Syria, okay?
Chemical and biological weapons is critical. That's an issue that doesn't just concern Syria. It concerns our close allies in the region, including Israel.
Chemical and biological weapons.
It concerns us. We cannot have a situation where chemical or biological weapons are falling into the hands of the wrong people. We have been very clear to the Assad regime, but also to other players on the ground, that a red line for us is
red line.
We start seeing a whole bunch of chemical weapons moving around.
Chemical
or being
weapons.
Utilized.
Red line.
That would change my calculus. That would change my equation.
So in this case, Dave, the president is setting a red line. Okay, this is before anything happens. And the basic idea is that if the evil leader or regime crosses this red line, then there would be justification to invade that country or to intervene in their affairs and maybe topple the leader or the regime, right?
Right.
So if the big bad leader uses the gas on the people, then we'll have to bomb that leader to smithereens, right? And but hey, surprise, surprise, that dumb bad leader does exactly that. Why? Well, of course, because he's so bad. That's why he does it. How convenient that is. I mean, how completely ridiculous that is.
They're now simply defining the atrocity ahead of time and then creating the opportunity, or if you subscribe to this concept of false flags, they simply create the scenario that then lets them cross that red line and keep doing what they're going to want to do, regardless of what's actually going on in the battlefield or wherever.
It's like they have to make the public aware, because of course there are atrocities going on around the world all the time. I mean, it's endless. And so they can't just say, well, we're going to intervene whenever there's an atrocity. They have to very specifically define it. They have to say, if this leader uses this gas, then we're going to be justified to intervene. And surprise, surprise, that's exactly what happens. And then people are like, oh, look at that. The big bad leader, he used the gas, and we should definitely now intervene. It's like we're pre-programmed now. We're pre-programmed.
Psychologically, people have, they already know, well, there's this line, and they're galvanized already. They pre-commit through this kind of telegraphing to whatever action the government takes once the red line is crossed.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to another example here, Dave. Do you have another one for us?
Well, another one I like is the crucified Canadian.
No, crucified Canadian.
Yeah, well, it wasn't always a Canadian. There's a few versions of this crucified person. Sometimes it's a girl, and other time it's an American, but most often it's a Canadian.
Oh, man.
So this was the another example that the Germans were being smeared with.
And so, but of course, that crucifixion never happened.
No, of course not.
Yeah.
And I mean, the key is, like, these reports were in reputable newspapers like the Times in the UK. This isn't just simply some kind of stuff that's just spreading through word of mouth. This is actually being spread by the papers of record, so people believe the stuff. Essentially, the definition, very definition of propaganda.
Yeah. Do you have another example, Dave?
I do, and I do indeed. This is another good one, another gem. So this is the corpse factory.
Oh, that sounds even better than the crucified Canadian.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's almost as good as the dead babies or the bayoneted babies. But so what's the setting here? Is it's there's a correspondent for one of the Berlin papers. He's writing by the name of Karl Rosner. He's writing what he says is. Last Tuesday, they published the first definite German admissions concerning the way in which the Germans use dead bodies. Okay, so this is what they're alleging the Germans are doing. And so he writes it as a narrative. We pass through Evering Court and there's a dull smell in the air as if lime were being burnt.
Oh, man.
And we're passing the Great Corpse Exploitation Establishment.
The Great Corpse Exploitation Establishment. Dave, as you read this, I'm just going to search for something. Keep going.
Yeah. And so he continues, the fat that is won here is turned into lubricating oils. And everything else is ground down in the bone mill into a powder, which is used for mixing with pig's food and as manure. Nothing can be permitted to go to waste. And this is the Times, April 16th, 1917.
I'm guessing that didn't happen.
No, it did not happen.
So it was a false accusation against the Germans, Dave. But even though it didn't happen back then, it might be happening shortly in America. Listen to this.
Imagine it. Part public park, part funeral home, part memorial to the people we love. A place where we can reconnect with the cycles of nature and treat bodies with gentleness and respect.
This is a TEDx talk.
The infrastructure is simple. Inside a vertical core, bodies and wood chips undergo accelerated natural decomposition, or composting, and are transformed into soil.
She's showing a figure, a diagram, Dave.
When someone dies, their body is taken to a human composting facility. After wrapping the deceased in a simple shroud, friends and family carry the body to the top of the core, which contains the natural decomposition system.
The natural system.
During a laying-in ceremony, they gently place the body into the core and cover it with wood chips. This begins the gentle transformation from human to soil. Over the next few weeks, the body decomposes naturally. Microbes and bacteria break down carbons and protein to create a new substance, a rich earthy soil.
A rich soil.
This soil can then be used to grow new life. Eventually, you could be a lemon tree.
You could be a lemon tree, Dave.
Yeah, indeed.
Oh, yeah. She gets an applause. She gets an applause. That was a TEDx talk. I actually found this when I was looking at an article in The Independent, which is a very left-leaning British publication. And the title of the article reads, Washington set to legalize human composting, the green afterlife that is good for the planet. Yeah, baby, go green. Put your carbon back in the life cycle. Dave, think of it. Your body can be useful even after you're dead.
Yeah, Hakuna Matata, right? Circle of life. No, it's hard for me to even joke about this. It's hard for me to joke about this because, as you know, doing funerals is one of the things I do as a pastor.
Oh, yeah.
And this kind of stuff, this nutty earth religion, become one with the planet. I've seen this thing, not exactly this TEDx talk, but ones like it, that they have slightly different schemes how to do this, whether they liquefy you or whether they put you in this composting bin of sorts and plant a tree. It's a spiritual reality. Just like Christians confess the resurrection of the body and the life everlasting, and we bury the dead intact to confess that, the same, you know, people are confessing what they want to confess with their spiritual religious understandings of what comes after death through these practices. But it's funny. I give you that. That's a great clip.
Yeah, I mean, you're basically a few steps away from then making a great TEDx talk about how you can use people for lubricating oil. And it's worthwhile thinking about TEDx itself for our listeners. TEDx, I think their tagline is ideas worth spreading. Yeah, propaganda worth spreading. There's committees that decide on what are the topics that are going to be talked about. And then these are propagated through this TED system. And everybody's led to believe that if you listen to TED, then you're going to be picking up some very important intellectual information. You're an intellectual if you listen to TED Talks.
Yeah, and funny, half of them are like advertisements for some kind of technology or company or product or whatever.
Yeah, or they focus on some messed up worldview. Dave, before we get off this Atrocity Lies segment, I just want to highlight one of the key themes of Atrocity Lies, which is the vilification of the enemy leader or leadership. And Harold Laswell writes about this. In fact, he has a chapter called Satanism, in which he focuses on how the enemy leader is typically painted as being Satan or something very evil like Satan. Here's a quote. I just got to grab my book. It's always difficult for many simple minds inside a nation to attach personal traits to so dispersed an entity as a whole nation. They need to have some individual on whom to pin their hate. It is therefore important to single out a handful of enemy leaders and load them down with the whole decalogue of sins. So the idea here is you single out the leadership and then you vilify them in speeches and in the media, and then people come to hate them and also the country that they represent. Ponsonby gives a great World War I example in a chapter of his book titled The Criminal Kaiser. And of course, the Kaiser was the German leader, and I'm just picking up his book here. And in the chapter, he shows that just before the war, the Kaiser was seen in a positive light. Here's a quote. Not many years before, his portrait had appeared in the Daily Mail with a quote, "Friend in need is a friend indeed," quote under it. And as late as October 17th, 1913, the Evening News wrote, quote, "We all acknowledge the Kaiser as a very gallant gentleman whose word is better than many other bonds. A guest who we are always glad to welcome and sorry to lose. A ruler whose ambitions for his own people are founded on as good a right as our own," end quote. And then, so that was October 17th, 1913, before the war. Then the war started on July 1914. And then he quotes from a Daily Mail article on September 22nd, 1914, where all of a sudden they call the Kaiser a lunatic, a madman, and a monster. And here's a direct quote. "Our great England will shed its blood willingly to help rid civilization of a criminal monarch and a criminal court which has succeeded in creating out of a docile people a herd of savages," end quote. So the Kaiser goes from being a gentleman to being a madman in less than a year. And of course, nowadays, we see the sort of vilification tactic being used heavily in politics.
Well, one example that, if we can jump in here, is the constant vilifying of Trump by the media, right? This kind of general, it would fall under D in your other techniques, the general obsession started by rumor, magnified by repetition, and elaborated by hysteria, which has at last gains general acceptance. And this idea that Trump is somehow a bumbling idiot, or that he's a liar, or, you know, there's a whole bunch of things that kind of fit this the bill that their media is always pushing against Trump. And so,
yeah, he's a Nazi, he's leader, all that bad stuff.
Yeah, one of the ones that I find interesting is that more recent event of BuzzFeed story where sources say that Trump directed Michael Cohen to lie to Congress about the proposed Moscow project.
Yeah, that was a false story, right?
That was a false story that came out. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about it is, so it's this whole idea of trying to paint a picture of Trump as being evil and a liar and a deceiver. And BuzzFeed put this out, apparently on sources, you know, the law enforcement officials told BuzzFeed that Trump directed Cohen to claim negotiations to build Trump Tower in Moscow ended months earlier than they actually did. Mm. The law enforcement sources told BuzzFeed that Cohen confirmed the special counsel, confirmed to special counsel Robert Mueller's team that Trump issued the order to lie to Congress. So this went out from BuzzFeed, and I'm looking at an article on CNN.com here. And then it says, CNN has not corroborated the BuzzFeed report.
Ah.
Okay. So, and then you look at another article that, again, it'll say the same sort of stuff, right? Report that Trump told Michael Cohen to lie to Congress draws rare response from special counsel. So first of all, this was so egregious that Mueller's or however you want to pronounce his name, a team actually put out a statement saying, no, these are false. And yeah. Then so they'll print this, they'll print the falseness again, and they'll say NBC News has not independently confirmed this report. Right.
Right.
And so,
they keep again, perpetuating it, never sort of denying it, but never saying they actually confirmed it. They just perpetuate it.
Yeah, that's right. So that's why I wanted to bring it up earlier as well, is just the whole idea that, oh, Trump told lies to Congress. And it's part of what you were talking about, this vilifying the leader.
Yeah.
And they never, it's actually falls under the lies not denied. I forget which bullet point that was, but it was one of those.
So what you're saying is, there is a single propaganda event, but that event includes multiple tactics.
Exactly. And this one, even though this one was denied by Mueller's team, what happened was, even after that, there was a 2 or 3 days where the networks basically ran with it, still trying to smear Trump with this thing and trying to deconstruct it and spin it. Well, we don't really know for sure whether this was true or not. They just ran with the story like it had not been refuted.
Yeah, and because I think they assume that a lot of people won't be paying attention to the refutation, and then they won't remember anyways, because the news cycle is so fast, information's coming at you so quickly, people just keep forgetting. Like, our memory has been so shortened now that we rarely remember the news from yesterday, let alone for what happened a week ago or 2 weeks ago.
That's right. And so as Ponsonby points, this is, you know, it's a general obsession started by rumor and magnified by repetition and elaborated by hysteria, which at last gains general acceptance. And so we've got the Trump Russia scandal. We got the president is a bumbling idiot. I got a good example. We'll get into that when we get into the fake photographs in a minute. But there's a whole bunch of themes that we could kind of make a list of, which the media tries to, through this repetition, to smear Trump with.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about Ponsonby's point where the government is basically spreading deliberate official lies.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I guess atrocity lies would be one example of this, but let's move aside from atrocity lies for a moment and focus just on broader deliberate official lies. And maybe we could bring this up to more current history and think about the messaging that followed 9/11. So for our young listeners, I'm referring to the events that took place on September 11th, 2001, when the World Trade Center buildings were taken down by airplanes that hit the towers. That's the accepted story anyways. By the way, as an aside for our curious listeners, you might want to track down what happened to Building 7. Okay. So go start Googling that and try to find out for yourself what happened to Building 7. And does that fit in with the airplane story that is the accepted story right now? But
yeah, just a note there. I think very recently YouTube just pulled a lot of those kinds of videos off of YouTube. So
ooh,
you may or may not be able to find it.
Oh, then that's going to make it harder for you to learn about Building 7.
Yeah, and so one of the things that is good to do is to save these things to your own hard drive for posterity when you find stuff that's along these lines, because you never know how long it's going to be up.
Yeah, and just to give you the quick 411 on that, Building 7 was never hit by a plane, yet it fell down at basically the rate of gravity and collapsed upon itself, and to this day, it's unclear why it did so. In any case, but let's just stick with the original thing. World Trade Center's fall down, and right after the event, we were told that this was perpetrated by Osama bin Laden and a small group of his terrorists. Somehow, Osama and these few terrorists were able to completely sidestep all the defense mechanisms that the United States of America has, and they took down these buildings with planes. They hijacked planes, and they took down these buildings. And from that point on, we had what was called the War on Terror. And so there was this war on this noun, terror. And it's very interesting because, remember, this allowed there to be a war on something that didn't have defined boundaries. It's just broadly a war on terror or terrorists. And then later on, all of a sudden, we're finding that the U.S. is invading Iraq, of all places. Now, bin Laden wasn't from Iraq, but all of a sudden, there's this invasion of Iraq as part of this war on terror.
That's right. Not only that, isn't he supposed to be hiding out in Afghanistan at that time?
Exactly. So I remember thinking to myself, why are these guys going into Iraq? Like, it makes no sense. But you sort of assume, well, they must have good reasons for it. They're the government. I mean, they have intelligence agencies and so on, right? Okay, now, in 2009, the British Prime Minister Gordon Brown triggered an inquiry into the events that led up to this Iraq war. And this was called the Iraq Inquiry. And the committee working on this was chaired by a Sir John Chilcot. And so the report that was published later on actually just was published in 2016. Okay, so much, much later. So 15 years later. And this report was called the Chilcot Report. The Chilcot Report included references to the correspondence between U.S. President Bush, so he was the president at the time, and then British Prime Minister Tony Blair. And these were correspondences that took place right after the events of 9/11, like within days. Okay, and remember that at this time, the public is being told it's all Osama bin Laden and he's hiding out in Afghanistan. And I have a clip here from a lecture by a British professor, Pierce Robinson, who is a professor and holds a chair in politics, society, and political journalism at the University of Sheffield. And he gives some background here. Listen to this.
This is one of the first documents, which is or pieces of information released by Chilcot. And this is actually within about, I think if I remember correctly, 5 or 6 days of the 9/11 attacks. You had a communication from the British Embassy stating that the regime change hawks in Washington were arguing that a coalition put together for the purposes of fighting a war on terror could be used for other things. It could be used to clear up other problems within the region.
Other problems.
And so you have, I mean, it's not just the fact that this document exists and so on, it's the fact that Chilcot chose to draw our attention to it in the Chilcot report. He's trying to get people to understand what was happening, where the Iraq conflict came from. But what you have here is the first indication that the war on terror itself was being seen as a way of doing other things in the international system. Okay, in a sense, and as I'll say at the end, the war on terror itself being a form of propaganda in order to mobilize support for doing this other heavy lifting in the international system, which is referred to.
So right after 9/11, Dave, they were telling the people that it was bin Laden, but they were actually planning to overthrow other countries, other leaders, including Saddam Hussein, and actually to engage in a much more broader conflict. So they're telling the people one thing, and they're actually planning to do something different. Here's another clip to listen to from this lecture.
This is a very interesting document. This is a communication from Tony Blair to George Bush. This is probably about 8 weeks after 9/11. And they'd had a discussion about whether to go for Saddam Hussein straight away. And this was something that the neocons in the Bush administration and Bush himself were advocating after 9/11. Can we use this to remove Saddam Hussein from power? And this is a plan offered up from Tony Blair that what they could perhaps do with Iraq to avoid a full-scale invasion is that they could support opposition groups, set out an agenda for post-Saddam Iraq. Tony Blair then moves on to talking about sort of we can then mount covert operations within Iraq, okay? And
covert
then
operations.
When there are rebellions occurring mm-hmm. with Iraq, then we can move in and support those militarily and then hopefully topple the regime.
So he's like talking about destabilizing the country, setting up rebellions, and then supporting those rebellions, right? Because we're often led to believe that somehow the uprisings in these countries were spontaneous by the people, and then the U.S. sort of goes in and supports these spontaneous uprisings. But here we have actual evidence that they were designing those uprisings and then supporting the uprisings that they created.
That's right. Can you say Arab Spring?
Well, exactly. Exactly. Let me continue this clip here.
And that's very interesting because this is, as I say, this is being communicated from Tony Blair. It's Tony Blair's writing going to George Bush. And it's giving you some ideas about other regime change operations that we might have been seeing, including Syria, as to what might have been going on
Syria.
In terms of the planning in relation to other conflicts.
So Syria happened much, much later, right? But they were already planning this after 9/11. I mean, this is shocking.
But what you have here, and just to put it very bluntly, you have no more, no less than British Prime Minister and American President plotting to overthrow a government. Completely illegal under international law, obviously.
Completely illegal.
Syria and Iran. This is a document setting out phases 1 and 2 of the war on terror. Because that's the other thing that Chilcot chose to draw our attention to, was that there was a phase 1 and 2 war on terror being discussed in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. And here's Syria and Iran. We have Tony Blair saying if toppling Saddam is a prime objective, easier to do that with Syria and Iran in favor or acquiescing rather than hitting all three at once. So clearly the discussion going on there is when to attack these three countries, with Tony Blair saying we need to back off Iran and Syria at the moment. Clear indication that there was a wide-ranging regime change operation being planned immediately after 9/11.
Now, remember, the clip's not over yet, but let me just interject here. Remember, the people are not being told this, right? The people are just being told, oh, there's this guy named Osama bin Laden. And
he's hiding out in Afghanistan, and we got to get him.
That's right, in the hills, and we just got to go get him.
Phases 1 and 2, this is the list of countries which are contained in a document from Tony Blair to George Bush talking about Phase 1 and 2 war on terror operations, and that's the list of countries which are identified.
By the way, the list of countries, he shows it on a screen there. They are, listen carefully, Iraq, Philippines, Syria, Iran, Yemen, Somalia, and Indonesia.
It wasn't entirely clear which of these countries were being marked for full-scale military action. Clearly, Syria, Iran, and Iraq were being marked for full-scale military engagement. What activities in the other countries was unclear from the documents. But clearly, you have a regime change policy being implemented and put in place in the immediate aftermath of 9/11.
So, Dave, this is very consistent with an audio or a video that you can find on YouTube of General Wesley Clark basically giving a very similar list in 2006. Listen to this.
About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld. And
by the way, that was 10 days after 9/11, okay? 10 days after 9/11.
And Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz, I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the joint staff who had used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, no. He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq. Why?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I guess they don't know what else to do." So I said, "Well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to Al-Qaeda?" He said, No. He says, "There's nothing new that way. They just made the decision to go to war with Iraq." He said, "I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments. And he said, I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail. So I came back to see him a few weeks later.
So a few weeks
and
later.
And by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, are we still going to war with Iraq? And he said, oh, it's worse than that. He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today, and he said, this is a memo that describes how we're going to take out seven countries in 5 years, starting with
seven
Iraq
countries.
And then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran.
Wow. So this is really fascinating because you notice that even these top officials didn't quite know what was going on. So somebody is planning these things, but it's not like everybody, at least in the top tier of the White House, is in the know, right? But you see, right, this would be like 10 days and a couple weeks later, after 9/11, this list is already in play. And notice that Syria is on the list. And it would have been many years before Obama and Hillary started to try and topple the Syrian government. But this was already all in place. And it seems to me that it really doesn't matter who the president or the prime minister is. The show is going to go on and on and on. It seems there was a plan. It doesn't matter whether it's Bush, Clinton, Obama, or perhaps even Trump. It doesn't matter. These invasions are going to happen. And this plan is going to be unfolded in the Middle East.
Sure, and that's why everybody's so mad when Trump announced that he wants to pull out of Syria.
Exactly, because it seems to kind of screw up the whole plan. They want a perpetual war there. They want a perpetual occupation.
Yeah, and if we look at all the rumblings about possibly the U.S. going to war with Venezuela to effect regime change there, it ought to make you at least pause when you hear this kind of stuff going in the background. And Venezuela's got a lot of problems, but I don't know, the U.S. doesn't exactly have a very good history with regime change.
Well, exactly. Well, see, this is actually exactly the point, and maybe we can come to this because we're kind of approaching the hour here, is that when you have propaganda being peddled by governments, and the governments have a history of propaganda, how do you know when to actually believe them? Like, how do we know what's actually happening in Venezuela? Can you trust the media? Well, no. Can you trust what the government tells you? Well, no. And this is a big, massive quandary now. Because for the average person, they're left kind of just being battered around with potentially disinformation on every side. And this I think, is the key tragedy of all of this.
Yeah, and think about some of the other countries, Yemen and Somalia, for example, which we get very little news out of, but this is where all these refugees are coming from.
That's right.
You know, there's military action in those countries, but for whatever reason, our Western media is covering nearly nothing out of that.
Yeah, and you always hear now the war on terror moving now out of the Middle East and maybe into Africa or some other places, right? And it could all be part of this big plan. But the point is, like, how do we know for sure what's true and what's not? Before we kind of end on that note, though, Dave, it's very interesting that then British Prime Minister Tony Blair even actually used the term propaganda in these various memos. Listen to this part of Piers Robinson's lecture.
Tony Blair is very open. I was talking about, you know, we don't use, or governments don't use the term propaganda in public. Well, they do use the term propaganda in private. And here we have Tony Blair talking about the need for a tightly knit propaganda campaign in relation to the war on terror. Here is another document, and this is one of Tony Blair's aides talking about propaganda operations, getting a communication strategy underway, rapid rebuttal, grid pushed out, and so on. And then finally, another document, not under the heading of propaganda, but fits within that definition, international initiatives in order to show how from 9/11, good can come from the world led by the USA. So talking about a humanitarian conference, talking about sorting out the Middle East peace process and so on.
So you notice they're going to frame it in terms of humanitarian efforts, which is a very common framing here. We're going to help. We got to go and help these poor people. Listen.
All attempts to try and mobilize and shore up support for a wide-ranging war on terror, which they knew at this point was going to involve multiple military actions against countries in the international system.
And this brings us to the American-supported Syrian civil war, okay, which is a little bit more recent. And remember, as part of that 9/11 plan, the idea was to create rebels within countries like Syria, then to topple the leaders. And so the American support is known to have started or maybe been in play by 2011. And listen to this clip by Professor Pierce Robinson.
What we certainly know about Syria is that we've had a multi-layered propaganda campaign involving think tanks, civil society organizations, as well as formal propaganda activities. And at the moment, it looks like it's an extremely extensive propaganda operation which has underpinned Syria.
Extremely extensive.
The propaganda operation of the war on terror has been massive. Syria has certainly been huge and has clearly been connected to what we see in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. The narrative, as we know, which has been emphasized, has been that we have a brutal, repressive Assad using chemical weapons versus a democratic revolution. And what's been obscured, and what we know now at least, has been obscured by that narrative, has been the extensive Western and Gulf State covert operations, for example, Operation Timber Sycamore, which has included supporting extremist militant groups within Syria. This conflict has not been a conflict which the West has been standing aside from. It's a conflict which the West has been very much involved in, and again, taking the link back to what we see after 9/11, clearly we see an evolution of policy, more or less moving in the same direction, ultimately leading to what we see in Syria and attempts to try to overthrow the Syrian government.
So again, we see massive propaganda techniques being deployed in this war in Syria. There seems to simply be nothing new under the sun. It's the same old stuff, and they're doing it over and over and over again, Dave. And we just kind of keep falling for it. Generally, the population just keeps falling for it. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I'm as you're playing those, I'm looking at an article, which Defense Department wants U.S. Special Operations Command to do more than traditional leaflets and loudspeakers approach to information warfare, senior Pentagon official said this week. They want to step up their game in propaganda.
Oh, yeah. They want to step it up.
And
they want to step it up in terms of trying to fill the enemy with propaganda, but they're also stepping it up in terms of feeding their own people propaganda. And I think that's the big lesson, one of the big lessons from this World War I propaganda, that the good countries, Britain and America, so the ostensibly good countries, were peddling falsehoods and lies to their own people. And the examples that we've given so far seem to suggest that they're continuing to do this. This wasn't like a one-time thing. In fact, they seem to have gotten better at it over time.
That's right. We're going to have to get into how are we doing on time? Are we?
We're at past the hour right now, or just
okay.
About.
So
at the
our commitment here is to try to keep this thing to about an hour or so, and so we're going to leave a bunch of information over to the next thing.
Yeah, I think we just continue this in the next episode. Continue talking about this because we have a lot more examples, and I want to get into what the role of the intellectuals was in World War I propaganda, and also what are the key consequences of the success of World War I propaganda. So maybe we should stop here, and then we'll go to those topics on the next episode.
Yeah, and we also got to cover the fake photographs. I got a bunch of great articles on that.
Oh, yeah. We'll give more examples for sure. Fake photographs, deliberate exaggeration. Oh, there's just so much to talk about.
Yeah, and then we're going to have to talk about how propaganda in the age of the internet gets confusing, and so we end up having to create laws that allow for propaganda to happen at home, and that's we'll have to get into that too.
Yeah, that's perhaps the most shocking part. But for now, since we're past the hour, Dave, thanks for all your commentary.
Yeah, and just why don't I put out our email? We have an email address for this podcast. It's notconformshow@gmail.com. So if anybody wants to reach us, one of these days we'll also get around to putting up our a basic site where we can put up some show notes and links and stuff like that. We got them. It just takes a lot of time to do it. But in the meantime, if you've got some feedback for us, or if you came across the killer money article that we should have talked about but didn't, and you want to send us a link, send it to notconformshow@gmail.com.
That's notconformshow@gmail.com.
That's right.
Over and out, Dave.
See you in the next episode.